But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. But don't play with me.
Good morning and welcome to Playing with Fire, Long Island's only food, wine, and lifestyle show. I'm your host, Tom Shordell, broadcasting to all you foodies out there on Long Island. I'm here this morning with, as usual, Stu Schrager, producer, friend, and confidant. Good morning, Stu.
Good morning, Tom.
What's happening?
Oh, way too much.
Yeah?
Way too much. You know, you and I recorded this wonderful, wonderful show last week.
Yes.
And at the end of it, although nobody heard it, I said, wow, this has just been the fastest in my mind that a show has been recorded.
Yeah.
And but it was lost.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So at any rate, here we go. We'll try to do it again.
I didn't listen last week, and I guess it was a good thing because you know, I don't listen to the show all that often because it's just at a time that it's difficult for me. And you know, I hate listening to my own voice on the radio because I sound like such a thug from Queens. You know, it's like you don't hear that when you're speaking, but you know, when you play it back, I get this like kind of flushing thing or something in my cadence, and I say you know a lot, you know. I don't know if you know that or not. You know, I say you know. So I'm trying not to say you know as much as I say you know. We'll see. You know.
Gotcha.
All right. But anyway, we're coming to the end of summer here, and you know, I'm trying to get in all the ingredients while I'm writing menus that I possibly can. I got tomatoes on everything. I got corn on everything. I got basil on everything. I have peaches and nectarines and you know, all kinds of fun summer stuff. And I'm kind of a little sad because, you know, 2 or 3 weeks from now, that's all going to evaporate. And not that I don't love the fall ingredients, I do, but it's always sad to see summer go because it's the end of the beach season, the golf season. I've only been to the beach once all year, and it's been kind of crazy. My grandkids, and taking two of them to the beach is, you know, a lot like trying to move a mountain, you know. So I've been pretty
I actually
non-beachy.
Got to go down to Robert Moses' on Thursday because I was a guest of the New York State Park Police and they had their annual family picnic.
Oh, yeah.
And again, you forget how wonderful and beautiful a beach can be.
Oh, my God. You take it for granted living on Long Island, you know. I mean, I've been here, you know, most of my whole life. And you know, you're just surrounded by all this beauty and nature and you know, I'm sure living in Ohio has its, you know, high points, but, you know, you don't see an ocean. You never see a body of water like that or, you know, I don't know. It's just that, you know, sometimes when I'm driving down, you know, out east or something, I'll take Wanto or Meadowbrook down to Ocean Parkway just to make that drive. I'll go a little out of my way and then go back over Robert Moses to get to 27. There's just something about it, you know. There's something about that whole marshland area, you know, when you go down Wanto or the Meadowbrook and you just see all that, you know, the bays there and the beauty and people fishing. I don't know. I would, you know, if I was relegated to Montana or something, like I said, I'm sure it has its own beauty, but I would certainly miss the water. And I don't know if that's because I'm a water sign or, you know, I don't know what that whole zodiac thing is, but I would totally miss seeing that. I think it's one of the more, you know, scenic things you can look at. And, you know, I've always been attracted to it. It's probably why, I enjoy cooking fish so much. I mean, I grew up kind of on the water in Bayville. My uncle had a boat there. You know, we used to go fishing. I used to stay with my aunt in Bayville for the summer sometimes. And it was like Huck Finn back then. You know, they had you know, raspberry, blackberry bushes and things that we'd go, you know, hunting for blackberries as a kid. And then we'd go down to the docks and fishing. When my uncle was home, we'd go out on a boat, you know. It was just great, great, great stuff, you know, growing up as a kid.
I understand. I mean, again, going to the beach on Thursday, just, it was like high 80s, but you had the beautiful breeze and the mist coming off the ocean. And the fine sea, forget how beautiful the sand can be.
Oh, yeah. It's fabulous. It's just...
And it's just... again, we don't appreciate what we have. We seem to always be critical of what we don't have, but we don't take into consideration what we do. I think it's based on that same principle, you know, half empty glass or half full glass.
Yeah.
people that live trying to find problems or people that live just to appreciate.
Yeah, manufactured outrage, I call it. You know, you can get mad at anything you want, but most of it's made up. And I also think happiness is, you know, 85% choice and 15% circumstance. There's certainly circumstances that can make you unhappy. But, you know, if you go out there looking for trouble, you're going to find it. You know, I mean, if you go out there looking for good stuff, it's out there available, too. So, yeah, I think that, again, getting back to the end of the summer, I was doing a dinner the other night, and I did this thing, and you know, if you're home, you may want to write this down. There's no real recipe here, but I did a fresh mozzarella with figs, grilled nectarines, a little fresh olive oil, chili, and mint. And I don't know if you're thinking, oh my God, those are disparate ingredients and they don't work, and you know, but trust me. And so what I did was I took I make my own mozzarella. So I won't burden you with that, but you can find great fresh mozzarella out there. I use the little 2-ounce balls. You know, I make them about 2-3 ounces, you know, so it's just enough for one portion. And then all you have to do is marinate that in a little bit of extra virgin olive oil and a little bit of red chili flakes. And if you don't want that, fine, you can leave the chili flakes off. I kind of think it gives it a little zip and it's kind of fun. And then what you want to do is you want to take a nectarine or a peach, cut it in half, and grill it a little bit, or, you know, saute it or whatever. Not to a point where it's mushy. Just, you know, get some grill marks and some char on it. And then you're going to slice that into like wedges and, you know, decorate around that. I also take some figs and quickly grill those and, you know, cut them in half and grill those and put the figs in there. And then you want to just what I call chiffonade, which is very finely julienne up the mint. And a little bit of fresh thyme, a little bit of fresh rosemary. Just take that off the little stalks there and sprinkle it on. And a little bit of sea salt and then maybe a little more extra virgin olive oil. And you have yourself one of the best appetizers ever for the summer. And I like to use a little grilled focaccia or something like that on the side. And basically you're just going to take a little extra virgin olive oil and a slice of focaccia or a slice of Italian bread or whatever, and use that on the grill also. Give that a couple of grill marks on there, turn it over. And be careful, don't put too much olive oil on, because if it starts to leak out, it'll flame up on you and it turns your bread all black, you know. You don't want that carbon and that char on there. You don't want the carbon on it. You just want the char on there. So do that, and then you can, you know, you cut that, take a piece of peach, a little piece of fresh mozzarella with the herbs, swash it around that olive oil, do the same with the bread, take a bite of each. It's just fabulous. It's great summer eating, you know. And it's a beautiful light lunch.
It sounds delightful. Yeah. I mean, I took your advice and partook of some Long Island corn the other day, and being the most unsophisticated gourmet on Long Island. I used to take the corn and wrap it in wet paper towel and put it in the microwave.
Oh, no.
But it worked.
Yeah.
But now I'm getting like very rustic, and I just throw the corn in the husk into the microwave. And lo and behold, it works.
Well, yeah, it's a natural wet paper towel, you know.
But it, you know, the ultimate is to take the time and effort to put it on the grill like you've taught us to do.
Yeah, well, I'm always torn with that, because there's interesting things you can do with corn on the grill, but, you know, corn on a cob to me is like a dental nightmare. I mean, you wind up with all kinds of stuff in your teeth, and it's just.
You're preaching to the choir. I was a kid growing up with braces, and
Forget that. You know, I mean, it takes you an hour to get them out of there. You know, all the corn stuff. You know, so. But, you know, then again, I mean, you know, if you want to do the corn on the grill is, you know, you could do Mexican street corn where you put a little chipotle aioli on it, a little cojada cheese and, you know, some fresh cilantro and a little bit of chili. You know, it's fun, you know, it's fun to eat. But I kind of like it off the husk, you know, for a couple of reasons. One is I get to make stock out of the husks. We call them corn bones in the restaurant, and you know, when I use them in the kitchen. And what I'll do is I'll save up a case or two, and then I'll make a stock out of that, like a corn stock.
And what, do you just refrigerate it to store it?
Yeah. I refrigerate the husks, you know, and then I'll make a corn stock. And basically what I'll do is I'll take the corn husks, and I'll put them in a big pot with, you know, fill it up with water, and then, you know, I'll use some herbs, and I'll use bay leaf, and I'll use thyme, and I'll use maybe some tarragon or basil in the water. onions, carrots, celery, you know, and just make this stock. And then what happens when the stock is, you know, flavorful, I'll take the corn out and I'll strain out the husks and I'll reduce that liquid by about half. And what happens is corn has this natural glycerin in it, and it gives you a viscosity to the stock that you almost get with chicken stock. And then I'll make, I'll do corn vichyssoise out of that. I'll do a cold corn soup with it, or I'll do a corn chowder or a sauce for fish or something like that. It's great.
So you got me thinking. So when we talk, I'm of Jewish ancestry,
mm-hmm.
and the miracle health remedy in my tribe is chicken soup.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
But I've really researched it and spent a lot of time, and I think I uncovered why it is and how it's so trendy.
All right.
So the latest thing is bone marrow soup.
Yeah.
What broth? What bone broth? So what is chicken soup?
It's chicken broth.
It's bone broth.
Yeah. Well, bone broth is basically beef stock. You know what I mean? Just renamed. You
right.
Know,
so this is the chicken version of it.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's got all the health ramifications that everybody's prophesizing about today.
Well, you know, a lot of these, what would you call them? There's a word for it, things that have been true for thousands and thousands of years. And, you know, chicken soup, yeah, soup is healthy. I mean, you get the fresh vegetables in there, you know. What they used to call it, Jewish penicillin or something, right? You know? So I used to make Asian penicillin. It was like an Asian chicken soup, you know, with green curry and stuff like that. It was, you know, kind of a play on words. Fun stuff.
So if we could hear the audience, they're going to be, pardon my French, peeing in the pants on this one. So I found during Passover frozen matzo balls. And I love matzo ball soup.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, actually, the best is...
That's soul food.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I, if on a regular day, I'll be able to get it at... Pastrami King in Merrick. It's
right.
it's really wonderful.
Yeah.
They're not a kosher Jewish delicatessen,
right.
The kosher style there. So it's an interesting place that everybody can feel comfortable. But as far as their matzo ball soup, they make it with a really nice curly noodle and chunks of chicken and the vegetables. And being I'm a little cheap, I always make sure to get my quart of soup with the matzo balls on the side. Therefore, I get
an extra spoonful.
Oh, yeah. Because in a quart of soup, three matzo balls take up a lot of room.
They do. They displace a lot of liquid.
So at any rate, so that's great. To be totally honest, I do find many times chicken soup to be a little salty when it's not cooked in your own kitchen.
Right.
So many times I'll get unsalted chicken broth to dilute it or whatever.
Sure, yeah.
But when I can't get to Pastrami King, I found out that there's a local chicken or poultry restaurant, Zorn's. They have a location in Belmore,
sure.
And they have one in Bethpage.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, they have matzo ball soup year-round.
Do they?
And what's interesting about that is they sort of found a niche market during the Jewish holidays for Passover. They'll have turkey and brisket and stuff and matzo ball soup.
Uh-huh.
But they've taken that to throughout the year, 12 months a year, having matzo ball soup. And it's pretty good, too. So that's my other source. But when I'm just nowhere to be found, I hoarded some of these frozen matzo balls. But there's nothing like having matzo balls with soup. And what I've ended up doing, and this goes back to your Asian aspect, I go to the Chinese restaurant and I get just plain chicken broth. And I keep that around. And it's always a well-seasoned broth. And, so I defrost the matzo balls. And then I use the broth from this quart of soup that I usually get. And...
wonton soup without the wontons?
Or? Essentially.
Yeah.
But, it's it works.
So, it's funny. I went probably – I've been cooking professionally for 53 years. I know that sounds like it's a long time to most people, and I'm only 35. So it's fabulous. But the bottom line is I've been cooking for 53 years. I think I made my first matzo ball, I'm guessing – 10 years ago, And I never really ate it all that much because, to me, that's a Ben's thing. You know, and I go to Ben's every once in a while, like once a month, I get the Wiggy for Jewish soul food and I'll go to Ben's. But I always order the mushroom instead of the matzo ball. I don't know why, you know.
Mushroom barley.
Yeah, well, it's fabulous.
They make it really good.
Plus, I mean, you don't get hungry for like 6 days after that. You know, it's just
that's
like
a heavy soup.
Yeah, rib stick and stuff. You know, and then I started. You know, I had a matzo ball soup once, and I liked it. You know, matzo balls to me, they're just meatballs made with bread. You know, kind of thing. And they're fun and they're tasty if they're made right. So I decided to do a Seder dinner at Cool Fish years ago. Because, I was in Sayas, a lot of my customers are Jewish, so I said, let me do this, that'd be kind of a nice thing to do, So I would do a Seder dinner, and I had to make matzo ball soup, and I'm sitting there scratching my head. I'm like, you know what, I have no idea how to make this, So I looked it up on the internet, it's pretty easy, So I started making them, and then I started getting into it. Do I do floaters or sinkers, I didn't know there was all kinds of, like, matzo, rules and regulations, and some people like the light ones, some people like the heavy ones, It was a lot of fun. But to me, the basis, and getting back to what you were saying, for any kind of great soup is a great stock. And what happens is, when you make like a stock at home, and you can make matzo ball soup with the things that you buy in a supermarket, the low-sodium chicken broth or whatever, and it's fine, whatever. But if you want to be like a real Jewish grandma, and make your own, it's really the way to go. And if you go to your butcher and ask him for some chicken bones, I mean, they have plenty lying around because they're always butchering chickens. You get yourself 5 pounds of chicken bones, and what you're going to do is you're going to make a stock. And, how do you do that? Well, you take the chicken bones, and I tend to roast them off a little bit in the oven because I like a little darker stock. So I would roast the chicken bones, and then I would put them in a big pot, and you cover them with water, and you add your aromatics. You add your onion, your carrot, your celery. I like tarragon in there. You don't have to use tarragon. You use parsley stems or, fresh thyme or whatever. And just slowly boil that. Let it simmer for a couple of hours. And then you strain it off, and you'll have this wonderful chicken broth. If you really wanted your matzo ball soup to stand out, I'm going to again tell you to reduce your stock by half. And what that'll do is it'll concentrate all the flavors. And you're evaporating the water, and the chicken essence doesn't evaporate with the water. The water, it's heavier, so it stays in. And so what happens is your stock becomes really, really flavorful. And, you strain that off, and then you're getting ready to go. And then what I would do is I would take different... a different set of onions, carrots, and celery. You're going to dice it up nice because you can have it in the soup. And I would also take whole chicken, and I would put a whole chicken into that stock. And, you're going to saute your vegetables. You're going to add your stock and put a whole chicken into that stock and let that, simmer for probably an hour, hour and a half. You're going to pull that chicken out, let it cool. You're going to take the skin off and pull the meat off. And then you're going to have this fresh chicken meat to add back to your soup. You make your matzo balls. And, I don't want to go into it here because it's pretty easy, with matzo meal. And every one of them has directions. You're going to mix it with a little oil and egg and, whatever. And make your matzo balls. And then and you're good to go. I mean, I think matzo ball soup to me, I never really ate it growing up because, I didn't grow up in a Jewish neighborhood, and Carl Place didn't have any Jewish delis at the time, And, I didn't eat it till I was an adult. But I think it's one of the simple gifts of Jewish cuisine that, A, won't kill you because some of that cuisine is pretty heavy and greasy and fatty. But B, it's just, like you said, it's penicillin. It's good for what ails you. It's what every Jewish grandma gives her grandkids. It's what, Jewish moms give their children. It's been around for a long time. And it's not only healthy, but it tastes good. And there's very few things that I can think of that, taste like wow and are really good for you. Most of the things that you love, like Twinkies, Hershey bars, that taste really good, aren't all that good for you. So Grandma Shaudel says, have yourself some chicken soup and live a long and healthy life,
There you go.
Yeah. The Jewish grandmas had it right, All the bubbies had it right. It's fabulous stuff.
So as you try to take control of the dialogue,
Jewish
morning,
cuisine,
and we get into discussions again about making the most of this, of what's left of the summer.
Yeah.
Is there any difference? I mean, I unofficially start the summer, Memorial Day weekend, and yeah. here we are in the middle of August.
Yeah.
Even during those 3 months, is there a anything that comes to mind that, you know, this time of year that's like, I mean, do you like purge yourself in tomatoes because it's like heart of the season and you're not going to have it?
You know? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's tomatoes, corn, basil, and lobster. I mean, to me, that's the summer, and I have it on my menus all the time. And it's funny because some of my cooks will go, you know, tomatoes again. Yeah, it's a gift that's here for 3 months. Let's use it. Oh, soft shell crabs is another one. You know, I start to see them now in April, which we never did before. They used to be around, starting in May. I start to see the first of season soft shells in April, and they kind of disappear around the end of September. But, you know, I keep them on the menu all the time. And, you know, people go, you know, especially at the club, you know, because you only have 350 members there. So, you know, it's not like you have this constant flow of new customers and stuff. It's the same people. And you're trying to entertain them as much as you can. And they'll say, oh, you know, I haven't changed the menu in 2 weeks. Yeah, well, this is what's here now, you know. Why would I, you know, avoid it? You know, black sea bass, halibut, I mean, things that... that come around this time of year that are just fabulous. I mean, let's use them while they're here is my thing, you know. And so if you have 10 items on a menu, you can come 10 days in a row and not have the same thing twice. And I always change 3 or 4 things, you know, on the menus. But, you know, it's the time of year to use that stuff. And I think that we're, you know, from years past, we're kind of spoiled because you can get pretty much corn year-round, you know. I can get corn up from Chile, you know, in the middle of the winter. Doesn't taste as good as the local stuff in the summer does here, you know, but you can get it. So I think people are spoiled. And I used to have an asparagus in December where, you know, asparagus season lasts about, you know, a month and a half, 2 months and begins in April and ends in June, you know. I think that's the way to eat. You know, you eat around the seasons. I mean, that's the way, you know, it always was until bird's eye and freezers and airplanes came into, you know, vogue. I mean, you know, because you could have, you know, you could fly anything up from... You know, I remember when I was, you know, out east, my partner was Tommy Mottola's right-hand man. And when he was married to Mariah, they had a combined, you know, income of $1 gazillion a year. So if she felt like having raspberries in December, he would dispatch a plane to Chile, you know, and bring up a pint of raspberries. You know, they could afford to do whatever they wanted. But it's really not a good idea. I mean, I think that, you know, between the, you know, the fact that, you know, you're burning up all that fuel and, you know, you know, it's environmentally unsound and yada, 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 all that stuff. It's just, you know, I don't know. You're supposed to eat what's available in your area, you know, cauliflower notwithstanding in the winter. So I think that, you know, when you talk about the local movement, which is really cool, it's not just about eating what's down the block for the sake of eating what's down the block. I mean, there's other considerations. There's transportation. There's, you know, labor. There's, you know, all this other stuff that's involved in moving these things around from, like, Washington State apples. I mean, why are we eating Washington State apples when you have beautiful Macoun apples right out east here? You know, let them eat that in Washington, you know. I don't get it, you know. But, you know, people do. And, you know, grocery stores, you know, they have these fruits are engineered to, you know, to last and to, you know, and to look good, this, that, and the other thing. But it's really, at the end of the day, isn't it about the flavor? I mean, some of the ugliest peaches I've ever seen come from Long Island, but they're fabulous.
It is about the flavor. I've talked about this before. On the weekends, I like to make my own sandwich. I mean, usually I'm just running around, so I go to the deli or whatever.
Right, right.
And what's going back to tomatoes, I like tomato on my burger or whatever. But, mm-hmm. you know, so many delis, what they do is they take a non-ripe tomato, slice it like, it's like a 16th of an inch.
Yeah, you can read through it.
Yeah, yeah. And but there's no taste.
No.
So I've gotten crazy. I have a mandolin.
Yeah, yeah.
And when I can get a nice juicy tomato, I just put it through there. But the tomato has taste. It adds to the sandwich.
What a concept, right?
Right. And then I go back to your story about sitting on the stoop or your grandma
My mother.
And, you know, a little bit of salt and eat it like an apple.
Yeah, I was horrified as a kid. I'm like, God, how can you do that? Now I'm adult. I'm like, why wouldn't you do that? You know, it's, you know, look, I've been involved in flavor my whole life. And again, it's live to eat, eat to live. There's a difference. You know, some people just pack food in because if they don't have it, they'll die. Other people, like, think about what they're going to eat, and, you know, they want it to be as good as possible. I'm in the second camp. And so if I'm going to, you know, Erica Marcus, who's a writer for Newsday and a buddy of mine, she does this thing every year where she makes, the first tomato sandwich of the year. And how many people have really thought about having a tomato sandwich? If I put it on my menu, I probably wouldn't sell a lot of them unless there was bacon and lettuce involved.
You're uncovering something that's been covered in my mind forever because I've heard of tomato sandwiches, but what I remember, you're like a therapist.
Well, Dr. Shortell is in. Feel free. You know what I mean? I'll give you the bill at the end of the show.
Fresh white bread.
Yeah.
Mayonnaise.
Yeah.
Tomato.
Right.
A sprinkle of salt.
Sea salt.
And it's a wonderful sandwich.
It is. I'm with you except for the white bread. You know, I'd have to go like wheat or toast or something like that.
Well, and I can understand that. So when I went down to the State Park Police picnic the other day,
yeah,
it irks me. And we've talked about this before, but if I have a sausage and pepper sandwich, it's got to be on like a semolina, you know, bun.
Yeah, of course.
I'm not the guy that wants it on a
No, you can't have it on white bread or something. Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So I can relate, you know, to what you're saying. To be honest, my mind now goes to a baguette, nice baguette with the little bit of mayonnaise. And I guess you can really go crazy if you use an aioli.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the tomato and a little bit of sea salt.
Oh, yeah, it's fabulous.
Or even now they got pink salt.
Yeah, well, Himalayan pink salt, yeah.
But, this could be delightful.
I have these ciabatta rolls that I use. It's from a specialty bakery in the city, and they're flecked with rosemary. So you have this little rosemary ciabatta. And I do a lot of paninis on them, things like that. But that's the perfect bread for a tomato sandwich. And if you want to put bacon and lettuce on there, fine. But you know what? I'm going to do a stew. I'm going to do a complete U-turn without the blinker. All right? You got to tell me what the Park Police had on the menu. And I'm going to tell you for two reasons I want to know. Number one is I'm always curious about food. And number two is I want to make fun of them because every time I decided to extend the speed limit on Ocean Parkway, I got reprimanded because I used to have a sports car and a motorcycle. Now I'm like a little older and more mature.
So they had hired a food truck for the day.
Uh-huh.
I believe it was called Felices or something.
That's good because they can't go more than 40 miles an hour.
And they served a hot and sweet sausage.
Right.
They had hamburgers, cheeseburgers, hot dogs. They had some macaroni and cheese, which, again, everybody has their own version. I believe theirs had some pieces of bacon in it.
Nice.
They had salad out there for people that wanted salad.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was a nice beach selection.
No, it was lame. It was lame. And the next, I have to yell at them a little bit because I get yelled at every time I was going down the Parkway at 87 miles an hour, whatever it was.
So, Tom, what type of vehicle do you drive?
Now?
Yeah.
Oh, now I have a mommy. Now I have a Ford Edge and I have a pickup truck.
Okay. So if you see those, it's not me.
Yeah. No, I'm not going to tell you what color it is either. No, I used to have I had a German sports car. And, where else are you going to open it up? There's nowhere else to go. So I would go early Sunday morning, you know. I go down there, pretend I was a race car driver. You know, I buy gloves with the fingers cut out and a scarf, you know, and a helmet. I put the top down, and I try to kill myself going from, you know, like Robert Moses to the Wantagh Parkway. And every once in a while, I got stopped. And to their credit, I never really got a ticket. I just got yelled at. So I just want to yell at them back a little bit. That's all.
You know, it's funny when you talk about that every neighborhood has their, in quotes, drag strip.
Yeah.
You know, in Oceanside, it's Lawson Boulevard.
Sure, yeah.
Has had some really horrific situations.
Yeah, it's not a good idea. I should go on record saying.
In Farmingdale, Melville area, there's Melville Road is a straight run.
Yeah, for sure.
People have done that. And it's legendary, like Ocean Parkway.
DPA a few times.
Yeah. So, you know, and some of these shows on TV, you know, Street Racers or whatever they are, Street whatever, I can't think of the name of it. It's probably encouraging all the wrong behavior, you know. But you don't see muscle cars anymore, you know. It used to be these, I remember my friend had this 454 Chevelle. The thing was like 200 miles an hour, whatever it was. And the Camaros and the Vets and stuff,
you know. What they do is I think it's Friday nights in Belmore train station. They have everybody gets together. This something at Captree over the weekends when I used to drive
car
for
shows.
The limo company. you know, if I was out and about, or like say I had a 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock pickup,
right?
And I had time to kill between, I'd run down the cap tree.
Yeah.
And it's an incredible. I mean, it's like going back into yesteryear. With the cars that are on display.
They're gorgeous cars. I mean, some of the, even, I remember a friend of mine bought a 57 Chevy when we were in high school, and it was blue. We had it all decked out, you know, with, I mean, it was white with blue trim. It was just gorgeous, you know. And some of those old Cadillacs with the fins and stuff, they're phenomenal.
Talking about Cadillacs. So I go down to a car show a couple of years ago at Town of Hempstead has down in, like, Point Lookout, and they had, like, Smokey and the Bandit. I guess that was a Firebird.
I don't know. Yeah.
And Cadillacs. But do you remember in the old days, Cadillacs had the interior of like grandma's living room?
It's
velvet.
Yeah, yeah. Quilted with plastic on it.
Oh my God! Yeah. It was like these velour cushiony. It's like being in a living room. The world was so different.
I know. My grandfather, on my mom's side, always had a Cadillac, right? I think it made him feel rich or something. I don't think they were $3,000 back then. But he always had plastic on the seats. And I remember my brother and I were getting into the car one time, right? And we're getting in the back seat on opposite sides. So he had his door open. I had my door open. I went to get in, and I slid all the way. I almost went out the other door. It was like, you know.
Well, that's like I dated this girl at one point who was into – like you said, nice, expensive European cars.
You better get this timeline right, because Kerry's listening.
I understand, yeah. But she knows Allison. So at any rate, so I go to get in her car, and it's like, you know, take off your shoes, put on your slippers. There's like white towels instead of mats. It's like, oh, my God. And it's funny you bring up Kerry, because Kerry's the type of person, it's a car.
Yeah, it's a tool.
It's meant to get dirty.
Yeah, it's a tool.
If you get a flat tire, don't fret.
Yeah.
If it gets dented or whatever, it's repairable.
Right.
Just totally different mindset.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I mean, I'm so hard on cars, I'm surprised they still lease me cars, you know, because I send them back in condition. I mean, I don't beat them up so much, but it's just, I've never upset. I think a clean car is a sign of a sick mind.
Well, then you understand my desk.
Yeah, no, I do. You know, it took me 20 minutes to find you today at the desk. You were sitting right there. Who knew?
So, you know, there's so much excitement here at WHLI right now. If you read Newsday this week, you learned that WHLI is now an AM signal and an FM signal. So we're always going to be 1100 AM WHLI. But now we're also 104.7 WHLI FM.
That's right.
So the AM signal is pretty incredible, because it goes anywhere from Brooklyn out to Montauk. An incredible reach. There's no other radio station on Long Island that can do that. And that's the AM signal. The FM signal is going to super serve Town of Hempstead, Town of Oyster Bay. It's like old-time radio. Because, like, I was traveling upstate New York, and each community, like, has their own radio station, and it's, like, very grassroots or whatever. So, again, the AM signal is always going to extend from one end of the island to the other. But if you want to enjoy listening to WHLI in stereo on an FM signal, and you're in Nassau County, essentially, below the LIE in Northern State, and, you know, around
here,
the middle of Nassau County, check it out. It's a really nice, bright sound. And hopefully for us at Playing With Fire, it's going to give us expanded listenership.
Yeah, and you know, we invite that expanded listenership to write us, right?
Yes, and that's where I was going.
What's the email?
The email is fire@whli.com. That's fire@whli.com. And again, when we do receive emails, they are responded to. We get to talk to the audience about them, and it's always interesting to share. We've had in recent times people sending in pictures of their gardens.
Sure, yeah.
And just a lot of discussion about content from what we talked about on the show that day. But I want to throw out an interesting challenge or just a fun game. Obviously, every once in a while we talk about food here.
It's hard to believe, but we do. Yeah, I know.
On Playing With Fire. So what I want to throw out, and again, mostly on WHLI, people come to listen to music, the music of the 50s, 60s, 70s, and then, you know, some of the artists of a lifetime, Tony Bennett and Sinatra and stuff like that. So Manilow, Bublé. So, again, very eclectic. But what I wanted to throw out to the audience is email us at fire@whli.com, but name some songs that include food in them. I thought that would be pretty cool.
That is cool. I'm trying to think now. You got me thinking, you know. Sugar, Sugar.
There you go.
Know, the Archies. I'd have to go to the 1910 Bubblegum Company or whatever.
But there's got to be a number of interesting songs that include food. Well, let's even expand it. Wine, libations. And then we can get real crazy. Maybe we can even include a song, a little bit of it, in the upcoming shows.
Maybe I'll write one. Maybe I'll write a song and play it on the air. You know, like I got them old Basil Blues, or you know what I mean? I got the Corn Saute Blues or something like that. It'd have to be bluesy.
Well, that's interesting that you say things like that, because I have a subscription to Wine Spectator.
Yeah.
It's an interesting publication.
It is.
Pretty big.
Yeah.
It takes over my whole desk.
Oh, it's huge.
But they had an interesting article, and maybe we can get into it another time, but it was talking about marijuana and how it's replacing many of the crops in California.
Yeah.
California had been known as one of the largest agricultural areas for wine.
Yeah.
And now a lot of the vineyards are actually switching over to growing pot.
I got to tell you, they've always been growing pot. There was a few that switched over to vineyards.
But then it gets into the discussion of cannabis infiltrating winemaking,
right,
and food and things like that. And it might be interesting to talk about it in a future episode of Playing with Fire.
I don't know much about it, you know, with a CBD thing or whatever. You know, I did smoke some pot back in the 70s, but I haven't smoked a joint since 1976, if any of the park police are interested. But it's been a while, and I don't know how I feel about it. I mean, you know, do we need another legal drug in this country? I mean, there's plenty out there.
Well, that's actually, again, and not to get too deep into it, but, you know, there's tests that are given when somebody's pulled over for alcohol,
right,
that measures the range of alcohol,
sure,
in your body. There really isn't anything for marijuana, to the best of my knowledge.
Yeah, you have to take a blood test.
It becomes like a perceptual thing by the officer pulling you over. I mean,
well, you know how you know? If somebody uses too many U's in the same word. I was just listening to some tunes, officer. All right, you're out of here. Come on. Hit the cuff, son.
Well, my mind went to the scene in, I guess, Cheech and Chong's movie, Up in Smoke.
Yeah.
You know, when you pull down the window.
Yeah, there's a barbecue going on in it.
So, but that's actually... one of the very big issues about legalization of marijuana is when you're impaired or not. And the thing that's also interesting to me, but I guess it's actually the same thing with marijuana as it is with wine. If you're drinking wine because it tastes good and you keep drinking it because it tastes good, like I guess if it's a summer day,
yeah,
and maybe you have like, I don't know, I've had a grapefruit type of wine or something.
Yeah, Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand.
But it just goes down so smoothly.
Yeah.
You can finish that bottle yourself. And
sure.
If you want a boat for the day, oh my God.
Yeah.
But, you know, with pot, the edibles, I don't know if it's actually regulated that each juicy fruit has the same amount of THC.
Yeah.
But I always go to the story of the chocolate bar that is laced with THC or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But you take one piece and it tastes good. And nothing happens, so you eat the rest of the bar.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you get zong. That's where I get confused, because food many times is about satisfying taste issues. You eat because it tastes good.
Yeah, for sure.
And many times you even overdo it. That's why, you know, your belly's
full. Why we're overweight,
but,
for sure.
You know, when you're involving pot and it can impair your abilities and you don't think you are, and then all of a sudden it hits you. You know, what is it all about? But that would be a whole interesting discussion for another week. Maybe we actually can get one of your friends that have pulled you over when many years ago from the State Park Police to...
Or maybe some of my friends who are pot experts, you know what I mean? I mean, I had one friend, he was like a pot sommelier. You know, he could tell you where it was from. You know, he would take a hit and go, yeah, South America, man. And another hit, yeah, Melendez Plantation. Another hit, yeah, row 14. You know what I mean? He was like his expert. I'm like, what are you talking about? You know, but I think with the dangerous part about it, I think with you know ingestion of a drug like THC through marijuana is it's almost like eating. You don't realize you're full until it's too late. If you eat quickly, you know, you've consumed more than you should, and then it's like, oh my God, you know. Where if you eat slowly, you kind of eat less because you get full as you're going. And it's the same thing with drinking. If you're guzzling wine, you're going to wind up whacked. It's the same thing with pot. I mean, I remember years ago when I did smoke pot, and I did, I was at a party with my friend Goose, who made some brownies. And so Goose and I, we ate a brownie, and he goes, you think we should eat the second one? And I'm like, I don't know. I don't think so. You know, so I go home, right? I get a phone call at 3 a.m. and he's on the phone. He goes, don't eat the second one, man, you know, kind of thing. I'm like, oh, my God, you know. So he didn't know. And he was at that point, he was too high. And we probably shouldn't be talking about this on the radio. But anyway, it's I don't know. I'm a little skeptical about it. I think that, you know, if there's medicinal, you know, aspects to it, great. But as far as. It's always going to get abused. I mean, you know, it starts out with good intentions and then it gets abused, just like alcohol. I mean, alcohol is great if you're, you know, if you're responsible and you're not driving a car and, you know, putting people's lives at risk. But to be out there on the road, you know, it's scary. It's scary.
It is. It is. So here's an interesting alcohol story. So I have friends that were out in Montauk and they saw some sort of blueberry-flavored alcohol called Montauk whiskey.
Uh-huh.
And they brought it back to me. And apparently the thing is to mix this with lemonade. Now, what's interesting to me is we enjoyed it. It was quite refreshing, you know, not yeah. something to go crazy about.
Right.
But so we had a couple of couples together and we devoured the bottle.
Right.
A couple of weeks later, we're getting together and with that group and Carrie said, hey, go get, you know, can you get that? And, you know, Montauk whiskey, you think is native to Montauk. Well,
yeah.
They were just using the name.
Yeah.
So it's really made in Brooklyn or whatever. So,
yeah.
But it just was a funny thing. But I go to, I know I always talk about Stu Leonard's, but I went to Total Wine, which is an incredible, credible store.
Yeah, it's Disneyland for winos.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And on Long Island, it's actually one store that's partitioned into two because New York laws say you can't sell wine in the same store that you sell alcohol. We can't sell alcohol in the same building as you sell beer.
Right.
However, what's strange to me is you can sell hard cider with alcohol.
It's rules for the sake
so
of
it's,
rules.
So it's crazy. So at any rate, if you go to a Total Wine in and most any other state, it's just one open room and everything's there. Again, there's two entrances with a partition here in Westbury. But that's where I found the Montauk whiskey. And what was so funny, and I don't know where these things start. Like, you know, you got rum and Coke and Jack and Coke.
They start because the spirits taste like crap. That's
well,
why.
But this is funny. So I get to the store and the shelf is empty.
Yeah.
There's no Montauk whiskey. So there's another couple there waiting also. So we see it on top. They had an extra case and brought it down. But I was saying, how do you serve your, you know, your blueberry Montauk whiskey with lemonade, of course. Now, how do these things happen? I mean, is it all like social media that somebody tries it in today's crazy world? They post a picture and then everybody follows.
It's probably a recipe suggestion from the manufacturer. I mean, you know, you get that all the time. Hey, use our bourbon in this, that, the other thing, you know. I mean, there's some people who like the taste of bourbon. You have these craft bourbons, these craft ryes coming out now that people go, oh, they're sippers, you know, and they kind of sip and they love the taste. Most people don't like the taste of spirits. That's why they put Coke in it and ginger ale and, you know, mixers and all kinds of stuff.
I've become at least smart enough to understand that if you're paying a crazy amount of money for one of these tasty scotches or bourbons or whatever, I find it not to be a drink that I mix. If I'm drinking, what do they call it, well brands?
Yeah.
You know, then, but what's the sense of getting $100 shot of McKellen keg and putting it in Coke?
No, it's crazy. It's crazy. It's I don't know. Listen, I've had very expensive cognacs, you know, and cognac is still wine at the end of the day. It tastes like a spirit, but it's not. And, you know, you look at something like Louis the 15th, Louis the 13th, or, you know, A. Hardy, or some of these really, really high-end cognacs and brandies. I mean, they're $400-$500 a pour, you know. So you're talking about, you know, 3 or 4 ounces for $500. $100 an ounce is, you know, fairly precious, you know. And I've done it only because of research and development purposes. You know, I wanted to find out what makes this thing that, you know, that special or whatever. And yeah, they're good, but, you know, it's at the end of the day, it's just a question of, you know, what you can afford and how much, you know, you want to throw at the luxury or the problem or whatever you want to call it. And I think that, you know, there's a supply and demand, you know, angle to it. There's not much made, so it's kind of precious and rare, you know. And those kinds of things, even like, you know, great batch scotches and stuff. I mean, you have these scotches that are, you know, $400 or $500 a bottle. You basically need to have enough ammunition to enjoy it. And I think that's what it comes down to. I think that most people who go, well, it's not worth the money, don't have the money to be able to do it, you know. If you have the disposable income, you know, or you have an interest in something. It's like, you know, a brand-new Callaway driver is probably $600, you know. And somebody who has $200 would go, well, that's not worth the money. Somebody who has $6,000 would buy it and say it's okay, you know. I think you have to be comfortable in the price range you're dealing with. But what happens is people go to restaurants or buy things that they really aren't comfortable spending the money, and then they wind up trashing it because it wasn't worth the money. Because the money was too precious. It's about the money. It's not about the quality of the product at that point, you know. It's like, you know, I went to this restaurant and it just wasn't worth the money. It was $3,000 and you know. So, you know, you basically want to say, well, maybe that's not the restaurant for you. Maybe you should go to a place that you're more comfortable with, you know, and eat there, you know. Because there's, speaking of eating, there's, you know, there are restaurants in every price category. It's almost like in the golf course, you know, people who go, and I'm making a crazy analogy, but you have 3 or 4 sets of tees at a golf course. You have the black tees for the pros, and you get the, you know, blue tees for the guys that are really good, and the white tees for the guys that are marginal, and the gold tees for the guys that are older, and then ladies' tees, you know. Right. Play the tee that you're comfortable with. Don't play the black tees and say this course sucks because, you know, you shot a 130, you know what I mean? It's the same thing with restaurants. Don't go to the black tee restaurants if you're a white tee guy, you know.
That makes sense.
Yeah, and there's no shame in it, you know. It's like, you know, everybody's, you know, comfortable, you know, spending what they want to spend. So, you know, just spend that and then leave everybody else alone, you know.
There you go.
Yeah.
So I have two more things for you today. One is for our audience, since summer is always associated with grilling.
Yeah.
And we're trying to build interaction between our listeners and us. Again, fire at WHLI, fire@WHLI.com. But as far as pictures, send us a picture of your grill with it loaded with food, and let's see what...
Yeah, and plating ideas, too. What kind of plating ideas do you have at home? And maybe I can help you with those and, you know, and make a suggestion or two, or maybe I can even steal your idea and use it in a restaurant.
Yeah. There you go. So now the other thing that I wanted to ask you is in days pre-COVID, pre-pandemic, it was very common for charities to have tasting events.
Yeah.
And in today's world where there's a shortage of help in the restaurants.
Big time.
Do you think that's going to be an ongoing thing where a restaurant's able to participate in something like that or, you know, It might be a temporary sabbatical.
Yeah, I think, well, most of these things happen on a Monday, you know, when most restaurants are either off or slow. And I think that any time that you people have realized you can raise a lot of money with free, you know, free food, free wine. I mean, not that it's free for the people who, you know, pay the VIG to come, but it's free for the people who are putting it on, so their costs are lower. I think they're always going to be around. And it's funny because, you know, we as restaurant people don't do them for the reasons that people think. You know, they always call you and tell you, oh, you know, we're going to have all these people. It's going to be so good for your business. Yeah, 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 whatever. I mean, I've heard that speech 1,000 times. If that were the case, I'd be jam-packed on Mondays. It just doesn't happen. I've done thousands of these things, you know. And we do it because, you know, we want to participate in the charity end of it. That's why we do it. You know, it's not like I think I'm going to get real busy because I, you know, gave out free food to 200 people. You know, I'm doing that because I think, you know, like the Magro Foundation or, you know, one of these charities, I think it's valuable to give back to the community and kind of help people who are a little less off than you are, you know.
So that be said, relating this to the pandemic, in today's world, a lot of restaurants did very well with takeout. There was no seating or whatever. But I know that in my mind, there's compromises in takeout. And it's usually the fact that it doesn't come out of the kitchen piping hot when you take it out of the container and after bringing it home. But if you go into it understanding that, you know, your expectations allow you to enjoy it. How do you think it's perceived, the sampling that restaurants do at these events? I mean, it's never going to be as it comes out of the kitchen at the restaurant. So do you think people understand that and accept that? And the fact that, you know, it's like unlimited food and people just go crazy. It's like the buffet thing.
Yeah.
You know, they as much as you can carry. So do people appreciate that, or do people get overcritical and go, why are they talking about that restaurant? It's not that good.
Yeah, no, I think people get it. I mean, you know, we don't have an oven there, generally speaking, you know. I tend to shy away from hot things, you know, because they're never going to be hot, you know. Although we do some sautéing or whatever, because we do have the burners. Yeah, I think people would just appreciate it for the fact that they're there and you're kind of helping out the cause. Because most of those people are doing the same thing. They're not coming there spending $50, $100, whatever, because they think they're going to get a great meal. Mm-hmm. Most of them are there to support the charity. And that's what I think about Long Islanders is, you know, I haven't worked in Ohio. I haven't worked in Oklahoma or whatever. But I have worked here, and I will tell you that Long Islanders are some of the most philanthropic and charitable people I've ever seen. I mean, they're constantly raising money for the downtrodden, the homeless, the, you know, the women's shelters, the, you know, feed the kids, the pediatric cancer care. I mean, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions actually, are raised for these people, which is, I mean, I can't think of a greater kindness, you know, than to, you know, give of yourself. And, you know, charity, to me, in order to be charity, has to be a little painful. I mean, if you know, Bill Gates writes a check for $100 million, right, to a charity, that's a really cool thing. But it doesn't really cost them anything. You know what I mean? It's like $100 million to him is like me throwing $10 to a charity. But if Bill Gates kind of, you know, goes to that thing and gives of himself and says, you know, I'm gonna go there. I'm gonna cook for these kids or these cancer patients, or I'm gonna show up. And that's a different thing because it costs you your time and your energy and everything else, and it's painful. It's, you know, I used to do these things where I would go into people's houses. They would auction me off like chattel, you know, and I would go into the houses and do a dinner for eight people or whatever, and it was a pain in the rear end. Tell you the truth, you know. I would rather pay for the dinner, you know. Here's your $500. I'm good, you know. But it, you know, at the end of the day, that's what we did. That's what was charitable. That's what made it charity to me. It was I had to disrupt my entire day and schedule and everything else to go do it. So that to me is more important than somebody with a lot of money. I mean, look, people with a lot of money give a lot of money. That's great, you know. But it's not as charitable, I think, as these people that work for these organizations that constantly give their time and their effort and fundraising and organizing these parties and getting the money to the children or the cancer patients or whatever. That to me is the real charity. That's the thing that the reason I go and help them out is because these people are doing such great work and nice things. It's not about the people that are going to come to the restaurant because they don't anyway. I mean, you know, I mean, they come, but it's not like they, you know, my business is going to increase by 50% because they, you know, I did this charity thing. To me, it's just, it's supporting the people that are trying to support these people who have all these difficulties. And that, at the end of the day, is what's important to me.
So you're somebody that's out and about, you know, this past summer. Were there many events that were being held, like with these tasers, especially on the East End, which...
They've pushed them all to September. I mean, you know, for two reasons. One is, first of all, they do them in the summer where everybody's busy. You know, it's crazy, right? And then wanted me to do this one. It's on like a Saturday. And this, are you kidding? You know what I mean? Are you too crazy, you know? Saturday's sacrosanct, man. You know, nobody can leave. But they pushed them off to September. And, you know, I've kind of backed down some of them. I haven't, you know.
I have to assume, I'm making an assumption. I heard there was polo out east this summer.
Yeah.
But I think it was on private residences, people that had, like, their own farms or whatever.
Yeah.
But, oh, my God, I'm sitting here talking, and you're giving me all these signals. I don't know if you're having an attack or something.
Well, I'm having an attack of the end of the show. You know what I mean? We've come to the conclusion, Stu.
Well, let's hope that this show actually airs.
Yeah, that'd be nice. You know?
And remember, you can listen to WHLI at 1100 a.m. or 104.7 FM. And for those who have now become accustomed to listening to us at 8 a.m., we are now at 9 a.m. So make sure your friends and family and people that are lovers of Playing With Fire know that we're on WHLI Sunday mornings at 9 a.m.
All right, we're going to close with Tom's Three Keys to Life, like usual. Life is too short to drink bad wine. Treat every meal like it was your last, and keep chocolate in your life as important as sex and pizza. And we'll see you next week at 9. Even you 8 o'clock listeners, we'll see you at 9.
Sweet Fancy Long Island is the award-winning dessert and pastry company that has become one of the hottest sources for bakery treats available for delivery on Long Island. Each mouth-watering creation has a personality all its own, teasing the palate with its rich flavors, complex textures, and eye-catching presentations. All items at Sweet Fancy Long Island are made 100% from scratch using the highest quality ingredients. Belgian chocolate, European butter, vanilla beans from Tahiti, and the richest, most flavorful fruits available. Their clients can enjoy any one of our delectable confections from one-of-a-kind pastries, specialty and occasion cakes, French macarons, and karma cups. Their signature line includes an assortment of charming, personalized size desserts served in miniature mason jars. The Sweet Fancy Long Island team takes great pride in presenting a unique, delicious, and elegant dessert experience and works closely with every client to create a memorable dessert that will add an exciting dimension to any celebration. Presently, the work of Sweet Fancy Long Island have been found in some of the area's top restaurants, country clubs, gourmet shops, catering facilities, and Food Network. Go to sweetfancyli.com to order online or to view their incredible gallery of desserts.
Amano Osteria and Wine Bar has been created by Adam Lovett and Tom Shawdell to bring the feel and flavors of a true Tuscan Osteria to the North Fork. Amano showcases local growers, farmers, cheese, and winemakers, marrying their ingredients with the taste traditions of the Tuscan countryside. The casual appeal, the flavors of Italy, and a moderate price structure appeal to all, ensuring year-round patronage. This North Fork eatery sends out snappy salads and seafood, pastas and antipasta, along with a respectable wine list. Amano features local vineyards and Italian varietals from the U.S. and Italian wines. The kitchen remains open until 11 and has established a later dining crowd, sparking a local nightlife dining scene. Amano is on the cutting edge of a new high-quality and affordable dining experience on the North Fork. Amano Osteria and Wine Bar, 13550 Main Road in Matatuck. Serving dinner daily, Amano is also open for lunch on Saturday and Sunday. For reservations and further information, call them at 631-298-4800 or visit them on the web at amanorestaurant.com.